This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about children's mental health. Issues around mental health have worsened during the pandemic, as many things have, due in part to a dramatic increase in isolation for some people. But has the treatment needed to address these problems been there for people in Indiana? And why has access and affordability for mental health treatment been so bad for so long? Later in the show, we'll talk to a mother in South Bend who spent years dealing with these problems firsthand to find out what she's experienced and what she's learned from it. But first, we're joined now by two guests from Aspire Indiana, a nonprofit that works to get people the mental health services they need. Amy Duncan is supervisor of the wraparound facilitator team, and Alyssa Pearson is an access coordinator for Boone, Hamilton, and Madison counties. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Alyssa, what trends have you seen in the last year with people that you hear from who need help?
See that in the past year, at the beginning of the pandemic, I would say things were running pretty smoothly. As time progressed, I see that the trend for intensity has increased for numerous youth and family. Families are calling more in crisis than we've seen in the past several years. I've done access for 5 years, and the pattern is that people who are isolated, lack of interactions with their friends, and being around each other significantly has increased the mental health needs of youth and their families. So I've just seen an increase in referrals in the past, I would say, 12 months.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about sort of these the intensity going up, would you say it's things like perhaps social anxiety? Maybe people aren't used to being in group settings anymore, or is it other things?
I do think that there's a lot of anxiety related to the isolation from others. You know, if you're a youth who benefits from being around other children and you haven't had that, you know, your anxiety can increase because of not having those interactions, as well as then the concern of anxiety, if you have significant anxiety of, you know, coming back into the world, things opening up. I think it can go both ways, both anxiety on not being around others, as well as not having interactions with others.
Mm-hmm. Well, Amy, what about your experiences? What changes have you seen in recent months?
Well, I tend to agree with Alyssa that we are getting a lot more youth and families in crisis. I would like to note that the anxiety not only is about the youth, but the caregivers now have had to be school teachers, working from, if they weren't furloughed or laid off, they were working from home while trying to teach their kids. So I truly have noticed an increase in anxiety across caregivers and youth to try to manage it all.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, what would the solutions be? I mean, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. But for the situation that we're in right now, if things continue to be sort of this unknown, some days we may go to school, some days we may not, what does that do for children?
I think that we need to make sure that they have a safe place to talk about their concerns. I think that, but we also need to provide a safe place for the caregivers to be able to talk about their concerns. I know that people who have a lot more natural supports in their life and have their own network going fared somewhat better, but we have a lot of people who maybe don't have that family or friend support to fall back on. And I think if we had more support groups, whether they be virtual or in person, for families to be able to talk to like minds, that would be extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm. And Alyssa, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree and concur with Amy. I think making those linkages with others is going to be helpful. I will say that I do think youth are very resilient. I think we see resilience in our youth and that we partner with, and that we see that same resilience. It just, they need to make those connections. And I do think families benefit from interacting with others who are in the, you know, the same journey that they're on of trying to manage their child, but also manage what life is handed to them, meaning their work life, their, you know, maybe their finances, things like that. But if we can connect those families to others, I do think it'd be a benefit.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the pandemic highlighted these issues for families and children that were always there, or did it present a new thing for folks that maybe wouldn't have experienced these types of things before?
I believe that they have, I think they've always existed. It just amplified it. Mm-hmm. I think it amplified what, you know, could have been managed with having opportunities to be out of the home and around others. I do think that the pandemic led to that isolation that a lot of our youth are experiencing. And so I just think it amplified it, but it existed. Mm-hmm. It just looked a little differently. And I think our lens on how to help others looked differently prior to the pandemic. And I think we all really are trying to adjust to helping others in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the common issues that most people are needing help with, Amy, what are sort of the most common things that keep popping up?
Well, I will say that getting providers into the home was very difficult through the heart of the pandemic. As more people have been vaccinated, people have been able to go back out in the homes and community a little more with proper safety in place. But I would say that the biggest need has just been having those supports, whether they be natural supports or paid supports, to help everyone manage and get through the hard times.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, if you don't have access to information for how you can find help for whatever your family's going through, what is the option out there for folks?
I think that's been very difficult, because one of the things that we found out at Aspire was we needed to be able to pivot really quickly, and everybody needed access to electronics that they could use from home whenever we provided more virtual services and supports. But not all of our families had the same access that we had. So mm-hmm. we also then had to find ways to link them to the electronic or virtual supports that they needed. And that took a minute for us all to get comfortable with how to best connect people. We were very, very fortunate, because we had a really good group of IT people who were able to access old devices for some of our clientele. We set up rooms where people could come into offices, even if they were doing a virtual appointment. If they didn't have access to internet or virtual needs, they could come in and we could put them in an office where they could get those supports connected by our secretaries and support staff. So we really had to think outside the box and get really creative with what we were doing to meet families' needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like in every sector, there's been some adoption of technology and different types of ways to reach out with folks. Well, Alyssa, I do want to ask you about wraparound services. I know we mentioned it a little bit at the top of the show that you work in that area. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So there's wraparound programming. There's two types of wraparound programming in the state of Indiana and all the counties. We have the Medicaid version of wraparound called Children's Mental Health Wraparound, or CMHW. We also have the non-Medicaid wraparound program, and that is a prevention program through the state office of DCS, and that's called Children's Mental Health Initiative, or CMHI. Wraparound is an evidence-based practice. All of our wrap facilitators in the state of Indiana are trained to do wraparound in the high-fidelity model, and that is done by the University of Maryland. And wraparound, in the truest sense, and how I describe it to families when I am taking referrals or obtaining inquiries is it looks like it takes a village philosophy. So that village includes, as Amy kind of referenced earlier, natural supports, the youth needs to participate, current providers who already work with the youth and family, providers who are free supports in the community. And then the paid supports come once a youth qualifies for wraparound. And then each family is assigned a wrap facilitator who partners with the youth and with the family to bring all of those individuals together. We are strength-based as well.
Now, is this service, has it been around for a long time, or is this a relatively new approach?
It has been around for a substantially long period of time, and it came out of a grant that the state of Indiana did, which then developed kind of the framework of how the state is doing wraparound. And so it's been in existence for... Wraparound in its truest sense has been in existence for almost 20 years. And so it's been around for quite a long time in the state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we have about a minute and a half left, but Amy, we'll ask you this, and if we don't get to the full answer, we can continue after the break. But have there been any special challenges that service providers have had to deal with in this area?
There have. So for many of us, we were sent home to work from our homes. So then we had to make sure our homes were set up for that need. But it also meant that we no longer had access to printers, places to store personal health information, ways to make sure that families could have private conversations with us, even finding staff to provide the jobs. There is a shortage across the United States of healthcare workers, both physical and mental health. So we really have had to think outside the box and really address those needs in a creative way.
Well, we'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about children's mental health during the pandemic and why access and affordability can be a hurdle for so many people trying to find help. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking today about children's mental health during the pandemic and what treatment options are out there for people struggling in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. With us again, our two guests from Aspire Indiana. Amy Duncan is supervisor of the wraparound facilitator team, and Alyssa Pearson is an access coordinator for Boone, Hamilton, and Madison counties. Before the break, we were talking about some of the struggles maybe that service providers faced during the pandemic. And Amy, you mentioned, you know, you had to change the way you did some things. Alyssa, how did you see the impact on service providers?
I believe the service providers really, again, had to adjust with what was needing to be done. So they had to shift how they did things. And so that means becoming really creative. And I think we had some providers who are pretty resilient in the fact that they adjusted switching to, you know, virtual appointments, and how do you engage a youth and family into those services in a different way. Lots of our service providers that we partner with got really creative. And some of them, you know, saw the increase in youth participation. And so I do think, though, that they had to pivot as quickly as we did in figuring out how to do that once the state gave us the directive that face-to-face did not have to be done in the home for their safety and the family's safety due to COVID. So I do think providers had to kind of figure out new ways to work with youth and family.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those new ways will continue even once things hopefully get back to normal?
I sure hope so. We have seen an increase on the access side of more families participating in their intakes to see if they qualify for wraparound. I know that sounds a bit bonkers, but we've seen families be able to do it in this way. And the no-show rate for intakes for wraparound for us has decreased. And there are some ways electronically that we've been able to do paperwork with families that, you know, are getting the outcomes of what we need for their services. So some of the things I do hope stay to make it more convenient for youth and family. But I do see the benefit of families seeing their providers and families being able to know that somebody is coming to their home to give them support.
Mm-hmm. So maybe like a hybrid style. I imagine that for folks that maybe if there's an increase in people seeking help electronically, it's more comfortable maybe and it's less anxiety provoking than having to go in person and it's easier not to get out of.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Well, I do see families being of benefit to kind of be more open in that setting. I do hope there's a hybrid model for us to follow.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the role that schools have played throughout the last year, Amy, do you see that they're able to help students who may have mental health issues or are able to connect them with the help they need?
I think it definitely has been challenging. One of the things that I appreciate is that so many different schools don't just have access to one mental health agency, but a variety of providers who have all been creative. So there's been a lot of splitting between in-person and virtual, even in the school settings, with as far as the mental health portion of that goes. So I think they've tried to be as supportive as they possibly could. There has been some barriers, though, when you have schools that have kids come back in person and then one child tests positive for COVID and they close that classroom down for 2 weeks. It has really put an interruption on consistency of the style of service, but the providers have really tried to be as flexible as they possibly could.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to schooling and mental health, did the pandemic enable schools to notice this as something that they can partner with and be open about, or have they always been pretty open?
I think that has continued to grow. I've been in the mental health field for a very long time. I don't want to say exactly how many years because it dates me, but I've been in it long enough to see that the more we talk as a community with schools and mental health providers, the more we realize that it doesn't have to be a one size fits all. So there may be two or three mental health agencies that are able to meet the needs of a school, depending on how large that system is, and different things for different kids, different things for different youth that are out there. They may not all need the same programming.
Well, on that note, Alyssa, when it comes to what children have been dealing with during this pandemic, how is their dealing with things different from how adults have been handling things?
Well, I think that youth in one avenue have been able to pivot a lot more easily. But it also leads to heightened behaviors. You know, if you're a child who needs predictability and that your schedule is changing, your school schedule is changing, you know, anxieties driven are substantially higher. You know, youth are can be can become angry as well. Like, where are we going? You know, I think adults, we have more ability to step back and say, okay, what direction do I need to go? Whereas a youth needs that guidance and that hands-on guidance. And those hands-on guidance have been there, but it hasn't been by multiple entities. So like your school teacher, maybe your guidance counselor, you know, your friends. And so I do think that we're seeing an increase in significant behaviors because less hands and people are there to guide a youth and family to, in the direction to get the right supports. And so I do think within wraparound, we're doing lots of teaching of how do you get through those moments and maneuver through that. And I do think youth need those supports and guidance as we serve ages 6 to 18 in wraparound.
And Amy, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that we have seen an increase in some of our caregiver mental health needs. I know we've seen a spike in addictions, but I also think in that anxiety and depression. So if you have somebody who is being expected to, they've always had to carry the load as a caregiver, but now they're also doing all of those social pieces and educational pieces. It's often wearing people out. I have a coworker who at the beginning of the pandemic said, I am not equipped to be a third grade teacher. And she's a master's level social worker. So, you know, it's stressful for our families. And I think that stress has really been a burden for our families, the caregivers, as well as the youth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is definitely tough to turn into a teacher overnight and have to remember multiple grades and things. And you're like, I thought I was done with that level of school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Amy, how would you rate the current state of mental health treatment for people in Indiana and children in terms of how accessible and affordable it is?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I think that we have far more access to mental health supports and services now than we did 20 years ago. But I will tell you that it's not a level playing field. Kids that have access to Medicaid have access to far more home and community-based services. So we have a lot of families who really are bearing the burden of finding the right supports for their kids and either paying out of pocket or getting support from other people because their insurance doesn't cover the cost of those home-based services.
Right. You know, and I've heard a lot about that. And I'm wondering, you know, why is it that insurance is so reluctant? Maybe that's a whole nother topic to cover mental health services. It's very interesting.
I do believe that our state manager of the Children's Mental Health Initiative Program, which is the non-Medicaid program, she has been collecting some data. And I really think that she is part of a group that is trying to figure this out to help find a solution to that need for those families who, you know, yes, they may have a great insurance plan and they've got dental and vision, but it doesn't cover a home-based therapist or skills person coming into the home to work with that youth that is really at a high level of need.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's something we'll have to keep an eye on if anything is going to be changing in that area. Alyssa, you've also been, you know, working in this area for a long time. How would you characterize things right now in terms of how much help is out there for people?
I do think that there's lots of programs that are out there. And I think it's what I find is a barrier is for families knowing that they exist. So one of the things as an access coordinator is making those linkages. I do think that over the past several years, Indiana has, you know, really made an initiative to get families linked. So as access, Our purpose for any access coordinator is to link them to the right doorstep. It may not be wraparound's doorstep. It may be other doorsteps that exist within the state of Indiana supports and services. I think that's where anybody who's working in the mental health youth serving world has those opportunities. What I find is I speak to lots of families who don't even know things exist. And so it's opening that door to say, hey, let's link you to these supports. Because if a child does not qualify for wraparound, we do not leave them high and dry and say, sorry, you're done. Our job is to link you to a support and resource that exists. The other great thing about wraparound and access is that a child can be referred more than once to wraparound. But again, our job is to get them to the right doorsteps. And I see that that's everyone's opportunity, is to link families to programs and services that exist. And there's lots of services around every community. It's just getting to the right person to get them to that doorstep.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to folks who are providing these services, Amy, we've heard a lot about maybe there aren't enough, there's a shortage of providers in the state or mental health workers. Is the problem that there aren't enough people going into this line of work, or is it high turnover? What is it?
It's a combo. So we have people who come into the field, and it's a stressful field. I'm not going to lie to you. It is very stressful. So we have people who come into it and think, oh, wow, I didn't expect it to be this hard. I will say the people that come into it and stick around are people who really enjoy helping families, and not that the people who leave aren't, but who maybe also are open to growing and changing themselves. So we really try to help encourage people to experience, you know, be more independent and be more creative on their own. If we have somebody who's working for us who wants to go back to school, we find ways to help them and support them in that, because we want to keep people in this line of work. We want to make it relevant for them to be part of the solution in helping families and to not want to leave. We also want to try to make sure that we can be competitive in our pay. You know, if somebody goes to the private sector and makes twice the amount of money, we got to come up with a way to make it appealing to stay in mental health and to continue to help families get to a better place.
Right, right. And Alyssa, what are your thoughts on, you know, where things stand for people getting into this field?
I see lots of opportunities for people to be involved in this field. I agree with Amy, is how do we continue to hold on to those individuals and building their skills? One of the things that I see is really trying to target youth coming out of college. You know, being a skill instructor in this field, you know, that's where you get your learning opportunities. So targeting youth who are or young adults coming out of college, this is a great first job, is to have lots of opportunity to learn. I do think retention is something that all mental health centers across the state of Indiana are working upon, because the workforce is needed. We have plenty of youth and families who are needing that service. And so I know each organization that we partner with is always looking at opportunities to retain, have, you know, providers grow, and to stay within the mental health world so that we have providers for families to pull from.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, Amy, are there any resources or places where people can go that are listening that are interested in getting help?
Oh, absolutely. So I always joke with my teams and say, you know, there's that lovely Google machine. If you just Google mental health services in Central Indiana, you'll it'll pull up a list of community mental health centers, as well as private organizations. Alyssa, as our access coordinator, is a fantastic resource, and she spends a great deal of time talking with families and getting them connected to those resources and supports. So I think not being afraid to ask is key for our families. Alyssa and I also spend a lot of time doing outreach. So we go out and we talk with schools and other youth serving organizations and agencies. We do interviews. We do what we can to get the word out about mental health, because not everybody knows how to access that. So I think if we keep the conversations going with enough people, the word spreads.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us, both of you. Amy Duncan is supervisor of the wraparound facilitator team at Aspire Indiana, and Alyssa Pearson is an access coordinator there for Boone, Hamilton, and Madison counties. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about children's mental health during the pandemic. Up next, we'll hear from a mother in South Bend about her experience struggling to find help for her son. If you have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobel. We're discussing children's mental health during the pandemic. So far, we've heard from folks who work to find services and treatment that might help someone with mental health issues. Now we're joined by someone who spent years struggling to do just that. Meg Hartz is a mother in South Bend. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, Meg, you were recently featured in a story by Carter Bennett for Side Effects Public Media. Can you talk about what your personal connection is with issues surrounding mental health?
So I have a 16-year-old son who was diagnosed at 9 years old with bipolar disorder. And since that diagnosis, we have been plunged into the world of mental health care and the lack of mental health care in our area, and just all the difficulties of accessing that care for him. It's been a very long and very arduous journey, trying to make sure that he gets the help that he needs.
Mm-hmm. And so you said from when he was 9 years old, have you seen things change in those years up to now? Have things gotten easier to navigate?
Perhaps they've gotten easier for me to navigate because I know what kind of the keywords are and what to Google. When my son was first diagnosed, we were told that we needed wraparound services, as you just talked about with the representatives from Aspire. I had no idea how to access wraparound services, and it sounds great that they have so much access down in Indy, but up here in South Bend, there is only one place to access wraparound services, and that place only takes Medicaid clients. So we were out of luck for 4.5 years.
Oh, wow. So you're saying South Bend is kind of isolated from other parts of the state in terms of having access to things.
It does seem that way. My son is currently in an inpatient and residential care. And as we were switching from inpatient to residential care, we had to look at facilities all across the state because funding is also another huge barrier to access. We do have private insurance. We do have funds as a family. We're not super wealthy, but we've been blessed with solid rewards for our hard work, which everybody else cannot say. So when we were trying to find a residential facility, there were very few that took insurance, and those that did take insurance required my son to have had 2 failed inpatient care stays before they would accept him. And he did not have those. So getting him into the facility that he is now, there were many barriers to, not only did you have trouble finding the facility, but then once you found them, trying to get in and match their criteria was also very difficult.
And, you know, I'm thank you so much for sharing this. I really appreciate it. And I'm just wondering, though, when it comes to insurance, we kind of talked about this a little bit in the earlier segments, just how insurance doesn't always cover these things. It seems like most people don't know that, you know, I mean, until they actually have to go and use their insurance and find out that it's not covered. What was that like for you finding that out?
Well, we had hit it on both sides. We've had, when my son was first diagnosed, there were only two pediatric psychiatrists within 100 miles of our house. One took insurance and one did not. When we went to find wraparound services, what we discovered is that the places that we went to look for did not take insurance. So it almost didn't matter whether our insurance covered something or not, because the places that offered those services didn't take insurance. So we ended up spending a lot of money out of pocket in order to get him the care that he needs. In fact, the place that he's at now does not take insurance, and we had to petition for funding through the state just so that he could stay in the facility where everybody recommended that he stay. Mm-hmm. So we had his therapist, the psychiatrist, everybody was on board saying this is what he needs, but they wouldn't take insurance. I couldn't even pay by cash. So it's not a question of whether only the wealthy get access. We're not wealthy, but we couldn't even, you know, beg, borrow, and steal access that way. You had to get it through either the probation system. My son is not a criminal, so that was not a viable option, or DCS. My son is not abused or neglected, so that's not a viable option. You can go through the state. Most of the time, you have to relinquish your parental rights in order to access care through the state, and we were not willing to go in that direction. So it was very difficult to find funding, even when we had the ability to pay, but no place would still take him.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's definitely a need to sort of revisit all of these rules or things that have been put in place, because it sounds extremely difficult.
Yes, it is very difficult.
Well, what about you know, when you mentioned the matching criteria to get into a facility, is part of that that there isn't enough space and there aren't enough resources for folks who need to use these facilities? Or was it all just about, I don't know, some kind of trying to deter people so they don't have to take too many people?
It could be a little bit of both. I think that we're in a catch-22 in the sense that in order for a child or teen, or I'm assuming adult, can get into emergency services, either a hospitalization or an inpatient, they either have to be referred there by probation or DCS or the courts, or they have to be violent, which means they have to be actively suicidal or homicidal. While we all profess to say that just because a person is mentally ill does not mean that they are violent, when it comes to accessing care, there are a lot of barriers if you are not violent. Your only sure ticket into accessing care is if you are suicidal or homicidal. So my son, even when he was in crisis, we would take him to the area ER or the area emergency psychiatric facility, and they would say, yes, you are right, your son is in crisis, but he's not suicidal or homicidal, so just take him home and call your psych in the morning. Mm. So you can't get those two inpatient or hospitalizations unless they are suicidal or homicidal, and my son is violent. So ironically, if you're not violent, they don't consider you in crisis. It didn't really matter if he was manic and awake for 5 days in a row and just needed to sleep, or if he was so depressed he couldn't engage at all in life. Those didn't seem to be crises because he wasn't hurting anybody but himself. So we did not get access to any emergency care that way. And then finally, when he was so ill that he was put inpatient, we couldn't access residential care for him because of those two. We didn't have the two previous inpatient or hospitalization because he wasn't violent. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge catch-22. And I know that it is a huge, there's a huge lack of services out there. There's just not enough beds for all the people that need beds. So I understand that they have barriers and criteria up. But at the same time, we need to be practicing some preventive care here. And if we are insisting that all of our mentally ill children become suicidal or homicidal, to me, that's almost the same as if your kids had cancer and you said, well, you can only access treatment when it gets to stage four. We understand that they have cancer and that sucks for them. It is life-threatening, but we're going to wait until stage four and then we'll have a bed. That's essentially what they're doing to the mentally ill is, yeah, that is a horrible situation to be in. That can be life-threatening, but we're going to wait until it actually is life-threatening before we let you in. And that's kind of been our experience.
Right. Well, we do have a comment from a listener on Facebook. I'm going to let you know what they say. Tarina on Facebook says, as a waiver case manager and a foster parent, I'm quite aware of what services are out there. However, actually getting the services is a whole other thing, especially when there is a child with intensive behavioral needs. There are so many families in true crisis due to the level of their children's needs, and there's often nothing available to support them. Staff don't want to work with highly aggressive people for low pay, so families are never able to get a break and regroup. It's heartbreaking and a tremendous strain on their families. These families love their child but desperately need a break. We as a state need to do better.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my son has not necessarily been violent. It has been very trying when he has not gone to school for days upon days upon days, and you worry that you know he has been so depressed and not getting out of bed. You can't leave him alone because you're afraid that what if he is suicidal. Mm-hmm. You know, we are requiring our kids not only to be suicidal but to tell someone that they are, and that's a whole different level that you have to admit that not only are you suicidal, but you have to express that to someone whom you don't know. That's a really high bar. Mm-hmm. And we're asking a little too much of our kids for that, to require that of them. And yeah, I don't mean to be sounding as if I think that people who are violent or people who are dealing with kids who have violent behavioral issues aren't struggling or anything like that. It's just that it's almost as if those cases are obvious, and it's awful that we are not doing anything for what should be obvious, but we are also failing cases that are not obvious.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you, as a parent dealing with something like this, how would you talk to someone who is hearing this struggle and now is just like, well, now I don't know if I should even bother trying to get access because it sounds so difficult.
I am. What I have actually told other parents is be persistent. It's worth fighting for, and be persistent, but it's not easy. And I do know a lot of parents, not a lot, but I do know parents who have given up. Because accessing the care that their child needs is too hard. And so they give up and they wait until the kid becomes 18. And then the kid is someone else's problem. I wish that I had some magic formula for accessing care. I tell folks, get on the wait list. Every place has a wait list. Put your name on every single one of them. I'm sure the people in the facilities hate for me to say that because, you know, it just makes their wait lists longer. But we have never had a wait list less than 6 months for any of the services that my son has been able to access. And wraparound, we waited 4.5 years for. So it's hard. It's not an easy journey.
Mm-hmm. And from your experience over these years, do you think that the stigma around mental health is changing at all, or is there still a lot of work to be done?
I do believe that the stigma around it is changing slightly, not as fast as I would like it to, but there is a lot more awareness. You see on posts on Facebook, or you see campaigns about getting help. It's not that there's no shame in getting help. There's the Stop the Stigma campaign. It's okay to talk about it. But on the other hand, we have all of these campaigns about eliminating the stigma. But at the same time, you know, we had the shooting in Indianapolis at the FedEx facility, and the first thing that was reported about the shooter was that he had mental illness. And that puts all of the folks who have mental illness right back into being stigmatized. People are scared of them because they are mentally ill. Even though the mentally ill are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. So we have a long way to go, but I do believe that the stigma is lessening, but the way things are handled in the media is not helpful. And again, requiring that aspect of violence in order to access care only perpetuates the idea that if you are mentally ill, you are violent. Mm-hmm. If we require our folks who are battling mental illness to actually be violent against themselves or others before they can access emergency care, then we are saying, essentially, you must be violent in order to be, I don't know, bad enough off to deserve care. And that's an awful thing to tell someone.
Right. And I know some of what we talked about in the earlier segments, there's a lack of service providers as well. So I wonder if that kind of complicates things too, just like this trickle effect from not enough service providers to needing things to be at a certain escalation. So it sounds like there's a lot of stuff that needs to be worked on.
Absolutely. And I firmly believe that we do have a serious issue with our service providers, not just from the lack of having them, but as you talked about in the previous section about burnout, if I kind of go back to that not great analogy of you know, only taking the people with stage 4 cancer, if you are a doctor and only see patients at the worst of the worst and you can save only a few of them, how disheartening and difficult that job is. If you don't get to see the people who you caught that disease early, that you discovered a screening process that could save all these lives, you know, that's a much more heartening place to come from and serve from. Whereas we are giving only the hardest cases, only the most severe, only the most difficult to our service providers, because those are the only ones that can make it through. And of course, our service providers are exhausted. I'm exhausted from dealing with my son for 4.5 years, and he's my son, and I love him, and I do everything for him, but it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine being a service provider who has to deal with, you know, 10 to 100 clients just like him. That's got to be hard.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Meg, for taking the time to talk with us and opening up about what you're going through. Meg Hartz is a mother in South Bend. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.